Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners. This is the Horror Hill podcast, and I'm your host, Eric Peabody. Tonight's episode includes two stories for you as we approach the darkest day of the year. To open, we'll be reading Necessity of Evil by Dale Thompson. In this tale, we travel to a remote village that's recently come under some new management. Believe it or not, Satan himself has taken control of this town, and while most of the residents have bowed their heads and accepted their fates, a few have decided that it's time to take action. Then, we'll close out with Paper Wasps by Micah Edwards. Our story begins with our unnamed narrator waking to a cry from his son that someone's in his room. While that in itself is enough to terrify most parents, the situation takes a turn for the weird when it turns out that the intruder is actually a giant wasp nest. From there, things keep getting stranger, forcing this family to reevaluate what it is that they truly treasure. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author Dale Thompson, I give you Necessity of Evil. We are each our own devil, and we make this world our hell. Oscar Wilde. He comes by many names: the tempter, the deceiver, the serpent, and a host of other not so flattering titles. He can look like you and me, or no one at all. We are instructed to be sober and vigilant and not to heed his vices. To give in to his seductions is to be ensnared, to damn your own soul. The evil one is an adversary to men, and though many do not believe in the personification of such a being and choose to play with fire, they are the foolish ones tempting fate. The earth and Sheol are his playground, moving with serendipity up and down in the earth as a lion looking for those whom he can devour. Satan is not divided, but united against all that is good. Pale knights, encrypted with suspense and mystery, patronized the simple townfolk with dreary hours of mind-numbing boredom. Most would give anything for a change, but those winds never blew in their direction. Stunted like a diseased forest, everything remained dwarfish, miniature, and meaningless. They would be forgotten not long after their last breath, replaced by an exact duplicate doomed to the same fate. They were unfortunate prisoners of the greater power. Appetites were non-existent. The suffering of severe stomach pains compounded with agiosia, food no longer held a delicate appeal. Dreams died with plans, future plans, and each resident accepted their mundane and sterile fate. They had fermented for so long in this capped condition that all volition and appreciation of the truth had been replaced by the obscure, the vague, a dream inside a dream. It had been shut in, locked behind transparent bars of threat. Surrender. All fight drained like the last drop of water from a canteen. All yielded without a battle. There were no preparations to hold their position. When the very one came who embodied all evil, swimming in the vastness of dark turmoil, he promised he could cradle the town and save it from utter destruction. Or he was just as content to act out of maliciousness and drown the town, wash it away as if it never existed, never had a rightly place on the earth. With no man of faith to withstand such a promise from a threatening devil, everyone, in their invisible shackles, appealed to the commissioner who had lived his life on the backs of others, using men like plow oxen to till his ground, plant his seed, and reap his harvest for him. There was never an opportunity presented to resist. Everyone submitted to the commissioner. This brought finality to the ontogeny of all within the sphere of his domain. There was a new rule now.
"Can you believe this? More potatoes! And look at their pitiful size!"
David was not happy with the feeding. Minute rations of mundane food intended to satisfy the cravings.
"Don't fall to pieces over tatters, David. Brittleness does not look good on you,"
Randy moaned as he slung his potato bag over his shoulder.
"I am just sick and tired of it. First we are rationed, then the bags are reduced in size, and now the potatoes themselves are smaller. These aren't even bite size. They're more like popcorn bites,"
David complained.
Randy agreed and added, "You're preaching to the choir here."
"It's too much. I can't keep making bland, tiny potato dishes for my family. I mean, give me a break. No salt, no pepper, not a single spice. We're slowly being starved,"
David criticized.
"Well, if you have the answer, I'm all ears. But the commissioner has made a deal with the devil. His pact has obligated the entire village,"
reminded Randy.
"Yeah, maybe the devil isn't the problem. Maybe the commissioner's the culprit we ought to be going after."
David was sounding like an anarchist, and in this climate, such an unpopular move would not go down well. He continued his harangue by adding even more rhetoric.
"And what's beyond the red area? Why are we limited to this small, contained area? It can't be because it's for our own good. Nothing good is happening here. We're dying, man. Hear me? Dying!"
Randy had no argument with David. Most everyone was suffering in the same manner, with the same afflictions and shortages. Some people never complained nor caused any sort of stink, but David could not be that person. A commotion outside of the collecting center caused David and Randy to take notice.
"What in the world's going on out there?"
David moved first toward the door leading out into the queuing yard where others had lined up for their weekly potato drop and collection. Randy followed closely behind. In the center of the area, two locals had presented a large cage on rollers, which was draped with a cover. It reminded David of when the days of on-stage magic shows were all the rage. David and Randy knew the two men well. Frank and Mark were former trappers who had been banned from trapping ever since the takeover of the village. All food was supplied by the new overseer, which was the devil himself.
"We got one!" Frank rejoiced. "You bet we got us one!"
Mark was just as exuberant. Frank gave the drapery a yank and it flung away with a whip. Inside the cage was a menacing creature. Fierce, so abominable, everyone either gasped aloud or fell coldly silent. It was hairless, with reptilian scales and a snake-like tail, but was forced onto all four limbs, whether by the containment or it possibly carried itself on all fours. The talon-like daggers protruding from each of the four claws were hooked and digging into the metal floor of the cage. Its eyes were vicious pools of venom and blazing with hate. It growled such a deep, influential tone that those who stood near it felt tingles on the soles of their feet. With such portentous diabolism, the vibrations slithered up the backs of their necks.
"We got us one! One of the devil's own!"
Mark swung the stick in his hand against the metal cage. The demigod winced and banged against the bars.
"What have you done? Are you trying to get us all killed?"
the commissioner cried as he emerged from his upper-tier apartment.
"Killed? I haven't found a beast yet I couldn't tame. If I can't tame it, we'll kill it, cook it, and eat it."
Frank's voice was loud and boisterously confident.
"Are you just trying to bring Satan's wrath down upon us?"
The commissioner was livid with irritation.
"We haven't heard anything from old Clovenhoof since he cursed us in this valley. He's abandoned us, out there in the universe, cursing other towns and villages. He's forgotten about us. Why do you think we're starving here?"
Mark barked, full of animosity.
"He hasn't left us. He watches all. He sees all,"
the commissioner argued.
"What is it anyway with your loyalty to him? He's done us no favors,"
Frank said.
"He has allowed us to live, and in living we should be a little more grateful. I've put my neck on the chopping block for this community, and this village exists today because I stood up and took full responsibility for your devout and unwavering commitment and pledge. I am the guarantor for every one of you,"
the commissioner said with a look of worry, as if he may at any moment be snatched away and consumed himself.
"I want you to take the creature back where you found it and never bring such danger into our village again. Do you understand me?"
The commissioner was adamant.
"What if we just turn it loose right here?"
Mark sounded serious. The commissioner had to determine if this was a threat or if the two foolhardy men were just going off at the mouth. Mark made an indiscreet movement with his hand toward the lock on the cage. This ordinarily prudent move proved to be otherwise. From the upper-tier apartments from where the commissioner had descended, a gunshot rang out and Mark went to the ground. Although the wound was superficial, he screamed in pain and crawled beneath the cage for cover, anticipating a second attempt on his life.
"I can make the consequences much more severe if anyone wants to test the rules. We have certain parameters, a set of guidelines in play in order to keep us in line. These are the instructions left by Satan, and we are to adhere to them to the very letter. We are to venerate his name."
No one moved, in fear they might become a victim of a sniper's crosshair.
"Don't just stand there looking at him. Get him to the infirmary before he bleeds to death,"
the commissioner ordered.
"And Frank, as for you, take the creature back where you found it."
As far as the villagers knew, Satan had not caught wind of the unfortunate episode that had occurred, and thus made no personal appearance upon the village. The commissioner believed
no news was good news.
Mark was on the road to recovery, sore and bandaged, but had not apologized for what he and Frank had done. David and Randy were down by the river and had their homemade fishing poles baited and in the water. They were told the river was sterile of all life, but there was no law preventing anyone from trying their hand and getting lucky. This also had a relaxing and therapeutic effect on anyone who wanted to do nothing at all but close their eyes and drift off to the sound of water. It just so happened that on this particular day, Frank and Mark stumbled upon the pair as they mindlessly fished.
"Did you dump the demon back into the forest?" David chuckled. "Why do you care? That idiot had me shot," Mark said, his arms still in a sling.
"Doesn't something strike you as weird?" Frank mentioned.
"Weird? Weird like how? Like three eyes weird, or just strange, like living in a village where Satan's your warden?"
David answered.
"They shot Mark. Doesn't that resonate with anyone? We are living in absolute mortal fear," Frank said.
"I won't disagree. I'm afraid. I really am. I'm not patronizing you. Yet, fear is healthy. It's there to keep us from putting our hands on a hot stove or trying to swim a river. Fear is not a bad thing," Randy said.
"I'm not afraid, and neither is Mark. That's what sets us aside from the rest of you," Frank said.
"You must have some fear. You took the demon back to the forest," David confidently assumed.
"Let me ask you, David, Randy, did you see me take the demon back to the forest?"
Frank asked.
"Don't tell me you've done something else crazy," David probed.
"Crazy? No. Smart? Yes. Do you want in on a game changer?"
Mark asked.
"Game changer? What are you two planning?"
Randy asked.
"You cannot say a word about this. I mean it,"
Mark threatened.
"Then why tell us and run the risk? Maybe you shouldn't tell us anything,"
David answered.
"We need you. We can't do what has to be done with just the two of us, especially now that Mark's working with one arm. Aren't you sick of potatoes? Aren't you tired of small portions, hardly enough to feed your family? And what happens if we're rationed even more?"
Frank asked them to consider.
"Let's pretend I'm not listening, and you say what's on your mind."
David gave Frank the go-ahead to let him know what they were devising.
"Here's the way I see it. Old Beelzebub's out of here. He's off possessing a nun or writing another symphony. He doesn't even know we exist anymore. It's only his demons that he has scattered throughout the forest, keeping us prisoner. Now, Mark and I have been deep into the forest, and there aren't as many of these demon dogs as you might think. We've captured 4, and we've trained them,"
Frank said, then was interrupted by Randy.
"Trained them? You mean you're training demons out in the forest?"
"Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Now, our village is 500 people strong, counting women and children, so that doesn't leave a massive amount of male resistance. I don't know the exact numbers, but the men probably outnumber the women by only a few. The commissioner has his small team of armed assailants, as demonstrated by the show of force against Mark. If the commissioner and his men are taken out of the equation, we won't have to battle an internal force to escape. We can make our way north, which we have found to be the most passable and least frequently guarded," Frank shared.
"Where do you propose to lead everyone to?" asked David. "If we can make it to the edge of the northern forest, we should be able to follow the river until we come into civilization. I can't imagine the devil has every village and town under his control,"
Mark said.
"How tame are your demons?"
Randy asked.
"They're like watchdogs. We've already seen that they're loyal, and that's what we need,"
Frank answered.
"Do you have plans to train more?"
David sounded curious about the whole thing.
4 more should be enough for us to attempt an escape," Mark said.
"How many do you estimate are out there?"
Randy asked.
20 to 25.
The 4 men entered into an agreement where they would work together to achieve their freedom from this town, to get out of this valley and to free themselves from the devil's chains. Most of their activities and preparations happened in the night and in the early hours of the morning. The demon creatures first had to be tamed enough to use them to their advantage. Knowing the town was very submissive to the devil, almost in a hypnotic way, they decided they would not try to save the entire town, but would focus only on their families. The fewer of them in the initial escape, the less likely that they would be found out. Frank practiced magic from a book called Fight Fire with Fire.
This was a book handed down to him from his grandmother many years ago. He hadn't even opened it until very recently. Now seemed like the appropriate time to use whatever magic they could. Charmed flames flickered upon four eager faces. A yellow glow like a funeral pyre burned hot in their eyes as Frank recited from the Book of Magic. He had said this was how he and Mark were able to tame the demons. It only took a couple of nights before the men had 8 demons under their control. They would use these now loyal creatures by riding them with their families to get as far away as possible.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
If the truth be known, no one knew much of anything about the devil. Most saw him only once, and the encounter left an impression. The devil had displayed petulantly horrid manners before bringing the calamity of imprisonment upon the village. From the time they became captives, the villagers became more sensitive to darker things, magnifying the worst of human characteristics rather than making themselves better. Most villagers had become voluble, more unpleasant, indulging in disrespectful gossip mingled with impertinence to a degree never seen before. This caused mistrust and suspicion, and the fellowship they once enjoyed turned to individualism. One often wonders what the devil knows. Is he as the wisdom of the ages? What is the devil permitted to see? Can he universally see? Or do the eyes of his followers serve as this all-seeing eye? The only reference the four men had on the history of the devil was a Bible story they remembered in the Book of Job. The devil was encouraged by God, permitted by the Almighty, to have the power to inflict Job with the most horrific diseases, plagues, and loss any human could endure. But oddly enough, God would not permit the devil to strip Job of life. The four men, David, Randy, Mark, and Frank, hoped that in their case of treason, the devil would have fewer powers as well. Once their plan had been enacted, the four men would be acting in a dark space with no promise and no protection. They and their families would be at terrible risk, so everything had to happen without a hitch. On the day of the escape, doubt had been set aside. It started early in the morning when the four wives of the men called on the commissioner and he granted them an audience. He was always eager to see pretty young women. Up in his 3-story office, the women explained to him this was an urgent, private matter and requested he send a security guard out of the room. They didn't want the rest of the town to catch wind of what they were going to share with him. He reluctantly agreed. He was narcissistic enough not to fear any woman, not even 4 of them. They had concocted an outrageous story of how they wanted a special area within the village to hang wet clothing because their homes were too small and crowded. It sounded ludicrous to the commissioner, but he thought of all women as ludicrous. While they were making their pitch, their husbands had moved their 8 demons from the shadows of the forest near the village. They had loaded these now tamed creatures with supplies for the escape and gathered their children. Each man had at least 1 child. Only David had 2 children, a boy and a little girl. Once securely mounted atop the creatures, Frank prepared the next phase of the plan. In the center of town was a small shack that served as the housing for lawn equipment and other various tools. Frank had no business around the shed because he was not the assigned gardener. With no one directly looking at him, he smashed the lock with 1 blow from a hammer he was carrying and swiftly entered in. He hoped that no one had seen his break-in. Inside, he doused whatever accelerants he could get his hands on upon the walls. He lit a match and walked out. He had made it a good distance away when the smoke began to roll from under the door of the shed. Someone yelled, "Fire!" and the village sprung into action. Even up in his office, the commissioner heard the chaos below. "Ladies, if you will, just sit here for a moment. I must see what's happening," the commissioner said. When he left the room, the women began searching his office for weapons. It had been rumored there was a small arsenal kept somewhere in his office, and this was their lucky day. In two of his desk drawers, they located three different handguns along with extra ammunition. Their work was done. They made their way from his office down the steps, passing no one, for the building had been evacuated and everyone was in the village center fighting the flames of their torched garden shed. Some people were overcome with emotion and were wailing indescribably grievous, undulating groans. It seemed that the entire village had erupted into turmoil. There were some retrieving water hoses from nearby buildings, and others, less helpful, lamenting, their faces turned toward the ground. By the time the fire was under control, the four men and their families were in the heart of the forest and putting distance between themselves and the town. No one in town had clued in yet. The escape was going as planned. Beneath the canopy of the forest, they rode their creatures as swiftly as they could on the marked trail that Frank and Mark had predetermined. The forest appeared to be changing, waking, and the markers that had been set out as indicators of the route were disappearing before the escapees arrived at them. They veered toward the river, for the river ran through the forest until it came out into empty lands. Back in the village, the commissioner and his triumvirate of yes-men had evaluated the arson and calmed the tumultuous scene. This is when it dawned on the commissioner that something was not right. He sent one of his men up into his office, and when they returned, the commissioner was informed that the women were gone and his office had been ransacked.
"Hunt them! Kill them!"
was the order the commissioner gave. The commissioner's face was red hot with anger. If possible, it blazed even hotter when he was informed the women had removed his handguns from the drawer. He practically snapped. The families rowed their creatures to the river and followed its course as closely as they could through dense and untraded bush. Howls were heard in the distance. It was obvious that the untamed demons were on their trail. The families were in the uncharted extremes, dire chimera, as if becoming lost in this navigational maze. Overhead, the sounds of black carrion birds circled. Their caws sounded hungry and pinpointed their position for the pursuers. If caught, the families would be purged from all existence, and the furnace would be their end. Under scrutiny, with microscopic confirmation from the keen eyes of the birds of prey who measured the nature of every living thing, the hunters were closing in. This was no time to take precision care or to plan the next move. The families had to stay moving. Howls and growls and the sounds of breaking branches were surmounting in every direction. They could hear the commissioner was meretriciously abusing his megaphone, calling out their names, making promises not to hurt them if they would only stop and turn themselves in. The forest crawled with shadows, unbeknownst to friend or foe, but the families being swept from the brink of sensibilities treated every unknown thing as an enemy combatant. The forest was beguiling and ever-changing. Enemies seemingly as innumerous as the stars were closing in, with hell to pay.
"They're gaining on us," Randy alerted.
"We're gonna run out of real estate,"
Mark said as he struggled with his bad arm. Like brazen hammers smashing through the forest, swinging abysmal rods of blasphemous, merciless destruction, the commissioner was indeed closing in. The trees filled with ghostly figures, which appeared to be a black death, dripping with sinister connotations.
"We can't stay in the forest. We have to cross the river,"
David advised. Behind them was pitch dark. Ahead was lightning and thunder, and to their left, a formidable river. Their strongest emotion was fear, the fear of being no more, of having done all of this in vain only to lose their families to the evil one. Blurred outlines and no direction, disintegrating with time as the forest was attempting to claim them for its own. The families clustered together on the riverbank, prisoners of their own emotions. The probability of escape seemed futile. Monomania broke their resoluteness. The wives sang an antiphoner to their children, an old church hymn, for comfort.
Pass me not, O gentle Savior, hear my humble cry. While others thou art calling, do not pass me by.
Surmounted by palsy, the hymnal, so graciously sung, snapped the men from their premature defeat. They put the discord and doubt out of their minds, and knowing dread would soon return, the men sent their wives and children on the backs of the demons into the water. Every option had been expended. Crossings seemed to be the last resort. The river sang to them with illusions of tranquility, which brought them comfort. The men found defensive positions. Mark was the only one without a weapon, but he refused to cross with the women, opting to stay and fight until the end. They could not say they had any assurance as they waited for the battle to come. Trembling as their taut minds sensed the danger near, they steadied themselves and held their positions. The forest fell deadly silent. Nothing stirred. An intense expectancy rose in their hearts as they sensed the invisible presence close at hand, lingering, looming, waiting.
What are they waiting on? David cursed.
The commissioner's voice called out to the men, addressing their emotions.
You don't want anything bad to happen to your families, do you? Surely not. Come on out and we can talk about this. We mean you no harm. You are a part of us. We can forgive and forget this ever happened. Rejoin us.
The four men said not a word as they crouched in a heavily wooded area.
My birds overhead see you. I see you through their eyes. You can't hide from us forever. We're not going back without you.
The commissioner's voice seemed passive, yet the men read something unusual in his tone. Could it be he feared as much as they did?
Your courage will fail you, and you will not be able to call on me for mercy. I am offering you the olive branch of peace. Won't you take it?
The commissioner was trying to flank their position. If he had their backs to the river, they would have nowhere to run, and drowning was as preferable a way to dispose of them as any other method. Dismay and consternation caused them to pause.
Do we fight? Do we swim? Randy asked.
Surveying the grotesquerie around them, they saw more limitations than opportunities. They looked at the river their families had crossed. For the time being, they were safe on the other side. Their families continued as they had been instructed into the next forest, which they prayed was their salvation. Wild, untamed demons were heard flinging themselves through the overhead branches. The men had sent all of the tamed demons with the families for protection. Now they wished they would have kept a couple back to aid them in this siege.
Can you see them? Mark asked.
No, but better than that. Look,
David whispered, pointing through the shrubbery.
The commissioner had foolishly exposed himself. He was standing straight ahead, looking about like a child lost in the woods.
David took careful aim. This shot had to be on target. The commissioner was just in the range of the accuracy of the handgun.
Take the shot, David! Take it! Randy encouraged him.
David took the shot. The explosion of the gun deafened the men as muted confusion erupted like shattered glass. The upheaval was such that David couldn't be sure if he had mastered his target or not. For an entire minute, pandemonium ensued, but the longer it raged, the fainter it became, as if in retreat. Darkness fell with a maligned cunningness that sank all hope of the men. He who had been concealed stepped from the unseen to the seen, from the invisible into the visible. It was Satan, manifested before them.
You will have to do better than this.
His demonic tones sounded like discord spilling from his throat.
I was slightly entertained, but you scarcely impressed me. You will be returned to the village. You will converse with those whom you have betrayed, and I shall continue to keep you, my pets, in this condition, for it is my good pleasure to bind you to what you loathe.
But why? Why not just let us go to be free? Are you mocking us?
Frank asked.
free. No one is ever free. No one ever truly has free will. You are dictated to, or you do not exist. Mocking you? You are the mockery, the devil answered.
Then let us die,
David rashly blurted out, still rebelling against the repulsive being standing before him.
I could let you die, but that is not the purpose I have for you. We are at the very rim of space. This is called the outer spaces, not outer space. It is here I've been afforded my projects, my games, my toys. You do not seem to understand that you are in league with me. All you have is mine, for I have given it. I am your necessity.
The four men stood defeated, eyes cast downward, deflated and beaten.
In your wildest flights of imagination, you cannot begin to comprehend the scope of my work. Your tiny minds could never grasp the vast arcane of true existence. Do not be appalled or believe I am obscene, for I keep you as my own.
Satan doted like a proud father. Time passed and structure was restored. The men's families were returned to the village unharmed to carry on with their daily duties as before. The commissioner was still mending from the gunshot wound, but showed no ill regard towards the men for escaping, nor for David who had pulled the trigger. The village understood more, since the great episode, of the integral part they played as a village and as individuals under Satan's care. Satan made many promises, which all knew he would never fulfill because he seldom spoke the truth. There were promises of space travel through the infinite cosmos, knowledge given which would provide answers to the mysteries which lay beyond. The great magnitude of his lies was far too enormous to weigh, yet the ever-changing timbre of his voice beckoned them, tugging valiantly at their heartstrings. The words seemed to bend to their liking and approval. The imploring, emphatic sincerity seemed like a surging, fatal plea. David and Randy smiled at one another. David spoke up as he tossed the potato bag over his shoulder and moved to the next cart.
How about this? Onion bags!
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You've been listening to Necessity of Evil by Dale Thompson. And now, to wrap things up, here's Paper Wasps by Micah Edwards. It started off with a cry every parent has heard 100 times before.
Dad, there's someone in my room!
It was 1 a.m., maybe 2 a.m. There was certainly not anyone in Dez's room. The house was locked, and his bedroom was on the second story. But I went to look anyway, because even though obviously there was no one there, obviously it was a nightmare. What if it wasn't? That's the real nightmare for every parent. What if this one time your child was screaming and you didn't hurry over, and it turned out to finally be important? There are always stories of accidents and abductions. All the logic in the world wouldn't fix the guilt if something was truly wrong and you didn't go check. So I hauled myself out of bed, waving my wife Petra back to sleep. I stumbled down the hall in my pajama bottoms and swung Dez's door open. The hallway light fell on his bed, where he was huddled under the covers.
Dude, what?
I wasn't at my most articulate.
He's in the corner! A giant!
I turned to look.
There's nothing. Holy chemise!
Parental reflexes are funny things. In about half a second, the situation unfolded like this. First, I saw a huge, swollen face leering down at me from the corner of the room, just like Dez had said. Second, I ran, not for the hallway, but for the bed, where I grabbed Desmond in a giant fabric bundle. Only then did I sprint for the hallway.
And third, I somehow corrected myself from swearing in the middle of it so that my 7-year-old wouldn't learn a word that he'd probably already heard at school and had definitely heard from my brother. The blankets in my arms were screaming,
"Daddy, it's got me! Help me!"
I'd like to say that I said something comforting or smart, but apparently I'd burned through my store of good parental choices in that first maneuver. Instead, I rolled the entire bundle as far down the hallway toward my room as I could and barked, "Go get your mother!" I had no weapon. I didn't even have a shirt on. I was going to have to face this thing alone. I took a deep breath and kicked the door all the way open.
"All right, creep!"
Only there wasn't a creep. As the door slammed back into the wall, the light fully illuminated the corner of the room. There was nobody in the corner. Literally, no body. What I had thought was a head was a large papery mass stuck up against the ceiling, an oblong nest maybe a foot across and almost 2 feet long. I let out a short laugh as I realized how silly I'd been. In the light, it didn't look anything like a person. It was probably just... All the adrenaline flooded back in. I grabbed the door handle and yanked it shut. I heard it tear free from where it had smashed through the drywall and splinter as I slammed it into its frame. I staggered back against the far wall.
"What? What is it?"
My wife was at the end of the hall, untangling our son from his involuntary cocoon. She looked as panicked as I felt.
"Give me those blankets," I demanded. "Wasp nest."
She blinked in confusion, but at least she shifted Desmond out of the way as I grabbed frantically for his comforter and stuffed it against the crack beneath his bedroom door.
"What? How?"
she asked.
"I don't know. I don't know."
My adrenaline crashed for a second time in a single minute. I suddenly felt lightheaded, like I might pass out. But the blankets were in place. The door was sealed. As long as I didn't fall into it and knock it open, it would be okay.
"Open window, I guess."
"It's December."
I didn't have the wherewithal to argue.
"Look, I don't know. I'll figure it out tomorrow."
"What about Des?"
"He's gonna have to sleep with us. I'm not fighting wasps in the middle of the night." I steadied myself with a hand on the wall as I walked back down the hallway.
"Babe, you should have seen this thing. Twice the size of my head, taking up half the wall."
"Maybe more," said Des.
Petra looked at both of us skeptically.
"Well, we'll see in the morning, I guess. Come on, everybody into bed."
As I lay back down, I wondered if Petra was right not to believe us. That nest certainly hadn't been there when I put Des to bed last night. Were wasps even active at night? My last thought before I fell asleep was that if they were, we'd better hope that they didn't realize my barrier under the door was only cloth. I dreamed of wings and stingers. When my phone alarm went off in the morning, I flinched awake at the very first buzz. I crept cautiously into the hallway, ready to retreat, but the blanket was still tucked against Dez's door, and there were no wasps to be seen. I peeled a corner of the blanket away and crouched down to listen carefully beneath the door. The room was silent. A hive that size would surely make some sort of noise if it were active. If the wasps were all out foraging, or whatever wasps did, it might be safe to knock the nest down and seal up whatever window or vent had allowed them inside.
"What are you doing?"
I jumped in surprise, with enough force to crack my head on the door. The hollow thunk elicited a laugh from my wife, who had apparently also woken up and was now standing above me, amused at the reaction to her simple question.
"I'm trying to decide if it's safe to go in there," I said. "Do we have any sort of full bodysuit, like a beekeeper getup?"
"Oh, it can't be that bad," said Petra.
She reached over me, and before I could stop her, she swung the door open. I heard her gasp, and I scrambled to my feet, scrabbling to slam the door.
"It's fine, it's fine. There's no wasps," said Petra, grabbing my wrists.
Her eyes were fixed on the far wall.
"I've never seen anything like that nest, though. Wow."
It was somehow more ominous in the daytime.
It still gave the vague impression of a face, a papier-mâché death mask for a giant. Its rough construction was more obvious now. The imperfections made it more threatening. It didn't look like art. It looked like a curse. But, as Petra had said, there were no wasps anywhere to be seen. That, at least, was a relief. "How do you think they made it so quickly?" she asked. "All I care about is how quickly I can get rid of it," I told her. "I'm thinking fire might be necessary." "What? Absolutely not. Be careful when you take it down." "We can repaint. It'll be fine." "I'm not worried about the walls. I want that nest." "You're crazy. I'm not risking my life because you want some creepy bug house." "Fine, then I'll get it down." "No." I heaved a sigh as Petra stared me down challengingly. "Just hang out for a few minutes. We have a bug bomb in the garage, I think." Several minutes of fruitless searching let me know that we did not have a bug bomb in the garage. I came back to let Petra know the bad news. "Babe, I'm gonna have to... What are you doing?" She was coming out of the doorway of Dez's room, the hideous nest cradled in her arms. She gave me a look that was half guilty, half triumphant. "I got it down. It was empty." She gave it a little shake to prove this. "Well, that's pretty lucky, isn't it? You know what could have happened if you'd been swarmed by that many wasps?" "We couldn't have thrown that poison in there anyway. All of Dez's stuff is in there. All of his toys would have had to be thrown out. Anyway, look at this." "I'd really rather not." "No, look what it's made out of. It's got newsprint in it. Look, you can read the words." She was right. The nest was covered in printed type and bits of black and white pictures. The words were stuck on at all sorts of angles, little scraps glued together with no rhyme or reason. There were columns and headline fragments jammed over top of each other. "Great, so we've got literate wasps. I'll put up a sign that says no trespassing so they don't come back."
"I don't know how you don't think this is amazing."
"I think we need to get Dez ready for school before I have to go to work, and I want to find out how those things got in before they come back." Petra gave me a brief pout, but she put the nest aside and went back to our room to wake Desmond up. For my part, I checked the windows and vents in his room, but could find no sign that anything was open to the outside. I wasn't comfortable leaving it at that, but I didn't have time for a more thorough search around the exterior of the house. I made a plan to check after work, and if I still couldn't find anything, we could just seal up his room again until we had time to call an exterminator. All of the extra activity put me slightly behind schedule, so I wasn't happy to enter the kitchen and hear Dez arguing about whether or not he had to eat breakfast. "You gotta eat something, bud," I told him, pouring myself a mug of coffee. "Come on, we're gonna be late."
"I don't wanna," he complained.
I sighed and grabbed a breakfast bar to feed him in the car. It would be better than nothing. I thought he ate it on the way to school, but after I dropped him off, I saw it sliding around the back seat of the car, still wrapped. He must have hidden it under his car seat. Kids can find the most amazing ways to cause problems for themselves. It wasn't a total surprise when I got a call from the school to come pick him up around lunchtime. Between the sleep interruption and skipping breakfast, I'd been more surprised if he had made it through the school day. They said that he had a slight fever, but mainly he just wanted to lie down. I made my excuses to my boss and ducked out to go retrieve Dez. "Rough day?" I asked him as we walked from the nurse's office.
"I don't feel very good."
"Well, that's why you need to eat breakfast like your mom was telling you this morning. That breakfast bar is still in the car if you want it now."
"I don't want it. I want a nap."
I thought about the unsolved problem of the wasps. "Hey, how about we put you in Mommy and Daddy's bed for that nap?"
"No, I want my room."
He looked uncharacteristically on the verge of a tantrum, so I let it drop. I figured there was a decent chance he'd be asleep by the time we got back anyway, and if he wasn't, we could have that argument then. Unfortunately, Dez was still awake when we pulled into the garage. I was mentally gearing up for a fight with a tired 7-year-old when we walked into the kitchen, and I totally lost my train of thought. Petra was sitting at the table.
The wasp nest was in a large bowl next to her, glistening wet. It looked more like a leering face than ever.
"Look,"
said Petra. Scraps of wet paper covered the kitchen table. It looked like a jigsaw puzzle made out of trash.
"Have you been peeling that nest?"
Behind me, Dez dropped his book bag on the floor and trundled off to his room to lie down. Neither of us noticed him go.
"Look at this. It's a newspaper," said Petra.
"Yeah, you said that this morning."
"But look at the date."
She had found a piece of the header. It had today's date on it.
"So, we found it Wait, how early do they deliver the papers? That thing was fully formed by like 2 a.m. "That isn't today's date. It's tomorrow's."
"Oh." I lost interest. "From like last year? So they just got into some old papers somewhere."
"It says the right day of the week," she insisted. "So unless that paper is like 30 years old, it's from tomorrow." "That doesn't make any sense. I've got part of the sports page. Are these two teams playing tonight?"
"Yeah, but..."
"And look, here's half a paragraph about a town council meeting. I looked it up. It's happening this afternoon."
"But..." "It can't," I sputtered, looking for words.
"What does this mean?"
"I'll tell you what it means." Petra pointed to a specific cluster of newsprint, her eyes shining.
"It means we're going to be rich."
The paper was crumpled, torn in inconvenient places, and translucent from the water. But still, the header was clear enough. Powerball. Below, assembled from various scraps, were 4 two-digit numbers.
"The other two are in here somewhere," Petra said. "All we have to do is find them. Hundreds of millions of dollars. But we have to do it today."
It was crazy. It made no sense.
"I can't believe this," I told her.
"Thought you might say that. Here, look at this one." It was a larger scrap, a nearly complete paragraph describing a hit and run on a pedestrian. It listed the intersection and the time.
"Hasn't happened yet, right?"
said Petra.
"Go see. You'll see that I'm right."
"You're nuts," I said. But I went. As I approached the intersection, I kept my eyes peeled. I still didn't believe Petra, but if somehow she was right, I knew how this stuff worked in movies. I'd be the guy who caused the hit and run, or the pedestrian who got hit. Either way, it would only have happened because I'd seen the prediction. I wasn't interested in getting involved in any time loop shenanigans. I parked carefully. I turned off my car. I stayed inside. It wasn't a busy intersection, but every time someone crossed the road, I tensed up. Was this it? Each time they crossed safely, I let out the breath I'd been holding and then checked my watch. The minutes were creeping by. It was always too early. I was checking my watch again, certain that the time had passed without incident, when I suddenly heard squealing brakes and a hard crunch. I leapt out of my car to see a person crumpled against the side of a parked car and a green Nissan speeding off. I should have paid attention to the license plate, but I was too shocked by the fact that the accident had happened at all. It was exactly as the newspaper fragment had described. People were already running over to help. No one needed me there. I was afraid of getting involved, of changing anything. My hands were shaking as I started the car. Petra was right. Somewhere in the layers of that nest were the other two numbers. More than $500 million, and all we had to do was uncover it. I had to get home to help. We had less than 8 hours until the entries closed. I burst back into the house with a breathless, "Have you found any more?"
"So it happened, huh? Believe me now?"
"Yes." I pulled up a chair next to her. "Intangible wasps built a nest in our son's room using a paper that hasn't been printed yet. And somehow, I believe that. Did you find any more of the numbers?"
"Not yet. I was thinking, though, even if we can't find any more, that's only like 5,000 options for the two we don't know.
We could buy one of each to make sure.
Only 5,000? That's $10,000. We don't have that on hand.
We can figure it out.
Her eyes blazed as she looked at me.
We can borrow it at 100% interest per day and still come out so far ahead that we'll never even notice it.
I'm not saying I want to. There are probably systems in place that flag that sort of buying behavior. But if it comes down to it, we'll risk it. She was right, of course. Still, it would be much better if we could just find those other numbers.
Okay, how do I peel pieces off of this? I asked.
Let me do it. I've got nails. You sort through the pieces over there. Make sure you check both sides.
We rapidly fell into a rhythm. She gently wetted down the nest in warm water, loosening the scraps that had been used to make it, then teased off the individual scraps to pass to me. I checked them over for numbers, discarding anything that was just words or pictures. The numbers got set aside to dry, waiting for Petra to check through them while the next level of scraps was slowly soaking free of the nest. I heard Dez call out to me at one point, but as I rose from the table to see how he was doing, a scrap caught my eye. It had a partial circle near the top with the bottom part of a W. Below that, at the bottom of the fragment, was the number 39.
Daddy?
Dez called again.
Be right there, bud, I said. I moved the scrap slowly toward the others, as if I thought sudden movements might scare the numbers away.
The circle W at the top fit into the Powerball logo. The number at the bottom was one of the two we were missing.
Got one! I shouted.
Petra threw her arms around me in a wet hug. Small pieces of newsprint clung to her nails. I hugged her back, but I watched those scraps anxiously. If any fell on the floor, I wanted to know where they had gone. Hours passed. The nest shrank and shrank. It no longer resembled a head. Now it looked like a misshapen heart. I could hear how hollow it was under Petra's gentle handling. We were getting close to the final layers.
What if there are eggs in there? I asked. Or larvae, or whatever wasps have. What if we open it up and there's a queen?
I don't think wasps have queens.
Don't act like that's the part of this that doesn't make sense. What if there's something horrible in the center and we let it out?
As I said that, one of Petra's nails pierced the final layer. She jerked her hand back and tore away a thick strip of newsprint with it. I flinched back instinctively, but although the internal cavity was large enough for a small dog, it was completely empty. There was nothing at all inside. Petra let out a shaky breath.
Well, answered that question, I guess.
I wasn't listening to her anymore. My gaze was fixed on the piece of paper dangling from her hand. It bore the circled P of Powerball. If it was a large enough scrap, it might have the final number at the bottom. I couldn't see the number on it, but it looked like it might be big enough.
Give me your hand, I said.
Petra watched as I peeled the wet newsprint away like sunburnt skin. I put it on the table almost reverently.
Is that it? She asked.
That's all six, I said.
Tonight's Powerball numbers. That's all of them.
We stared at them for a moment. I felt a mix of awe and fear. This didn't feel real. I'd seen the accident, though. This was future information. This was going to change everything.
We have to go buy a ticket, Petra whispered. There's only a couple of hours left.
We both went. I think we both had the feeling that if we let the other one out of our sight, the whole impossible idea might collapse. We checked the numbers a dozen times as we put them into the machine. $2 was such an insanely small amount to exchange for a slip of paper that was going to be worth so much. When we got back home, I half expected the nest to be gone, but it was still there, torn apart and spread all over our kitchen table.
You'd better clean this up if you want to have dinner, Petra said.
Her mouth suddenly opened into an O of shock.
Desmond! Oh, poor baby hasn't eaten anything all day, and we let him sleep through dinner.
I'll go see if he wants anything, I said.
I shuffled down the hall and knocked gently on his door.
Des,
Buddy, you awake?
There was no answer, though I did hear a quiet drone like a sustained snore. I eased the door open. The light fell across the bed. Desmond's eyes were closed. His mouth was hanging open. The purple sheets were bunched up over his body and moving strangely, as if he was running his hands up and down underneath. Des's sheets are blue, I thought. My mind would go no further, though I already knew the truth. I could see where the sheets were blue at the bottom, could see where the purple was thickest and shining its true red in the light from the hallway. I stepped robotically inside the room. Desmond did not move. The sheets continued to writhe and pulse. I reached down. I took hold of a corner. I pulled them aside. Wasps. Thousands, tens of thousands. They flew up in a cloud, boiling out of the red ruin of Dez's belly. Their wing beats droned frantically as they escaped the confines of the blankets and flew, neither at me nor away, but rather away from everything. They grew smaller and smaller, disappearing down a long hallway without changing position at all. I heard Petra scream behind me as the last of the wasps vanished. I saw the Powerball ticket fall from her hand as she rushed across the floor to the torn and chewed body of our son. I heard her sobs, great racking cries of loss and guilt. I looked at the blood on my hands. I looked at the ticket on the floor. The numbers would be valid, I knew, just as I knew that tomorrow's newspaper would be chewed to pieces to make another nest. I intended to keep that newspaper as close to me as possible. Whenever the wasps came for it, however they arrived, I would kill as many of them as I could. I couldn't change anything. The Powerball numbers would win, but the wasp nest had been hollow. Maybe I would be able to deny them something.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You've just heard Paper Wasps by Micah Edwards. Micah Edwards graduated from William & Mary with a degree in English and no particular plans to use it. He now finds himself occupying various roles as an author, a comedian, and a database administrator, depending on the day of the week. He resides in Richmond, Virginia, the world's premier home of authors named Micah Edwards. Well, my friends, that wraps things up for tonight. Please join me in thanking Dale Thompson and Micah Edwards for their stories. And, of course, thanks to you as well, dear listeners. Next week's episode is both the final entry in Season 11 of Horror Hill and is also the last episode of 2024. We're going to be closing out with a bang, featuring a very old tale that I'm sure many of you know quite well. Be sure to join me next week as we close out the year and season with gusto. And, as always, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace,
but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only, some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.